We're going to call the meeting to order. Representative Poston, if you had an opportunity, look at the minutes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have. I'd like to move the minutes from February 19th.
Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes pass. We will move on to our first bill. Representative Wolgamont, would you take the chair, please? You know your motion? Okay, move it. Pull it over. Okay, Representative Wolgamont, I understand you're going to move to refer this to the General Registry. Is that correct?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Proceed.
Jack.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm here this morning to present to you.
Hold on just a second, Representative.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I think this needs to go to Ways and Means.
Let's amend it to go to the Ways and Means. How's that?
So moved.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm here this morning to present House File 1615. Last year, this committee worked to address the immediate security staffing needs for our correctional facilities by appropriating money for more corrections officers and to provide recruitment incentives to help reduce the vacancy rates. This was in response to the tragic murder of Officer Joseph Gom at Stillwater and the death of Officer Joe Perez at Oak Park Heights. Mr. Chair, members, new officers are crucial in addressing the safety concerns of our incarcerated populations and the staff that work there. More COs, however, are just one piece of the puzzle for an effective safety and rehabilitative correctional program. In addition to the deterrent effect and reactionary nature of security personnel, we need to address the serious lack of vocational and therapeutic resources available in correctional facilities to the facility residents that provide behavioral modifications proven to reduce and prevent violence in the facilities and help residents get the programming they need to reduce the likelihood of recidivism. Mr. Chair, members, this bill, House File 1615, provides an additional 176 support and clinical staff in state correctional facilities. It was heard last year in this committee, but Mr. Chair, members, we've got to take action on this. We are here again to keep this issue alive going into next year's budget session. The stakes are too high and the consequences are too dire. With that, Mr. Chair, members, I'll turn it over to my two testifiers, and we'll be happy to stand for any questions.
Devin, you want to, you know how to do this, right? Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Devin Bruce. I am the Public Affairs Coordinator for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. We are a union that represents over 15,000 state employees across all state agencies and boards, including clinical and programming staff in the 11 state correctional facilities. To ensure our member has enough time to talk about her story and her experience in the Lionel Lakes facility, I'll be pretty brief. The OLA report on safety and security in our state facilities was not a surprise to anybody that works there. As Representative Wolgamont stated, we began work on addressing the critical situation of hiring more officers to provide security to our incarcerated population and our staff, but without giving resources to the clinical, vocational, and support staff, programs that as the OLA report cites as a vital piece to offender behavior modification and rehabilitation, will continue to treat the symptoms instead of attending to the underlying causes. The vast majority of our residents at our facilities will be released back into the community. We need to ensure that our staff have the resources they need to ensure that reentry is successful. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Winsberger.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Robin Winsberger, and I work at the for the Minnesota Department of Corrections at the Lionel Lakes facility. I'm a clinical program therapist, and I work in the triad program. I've worked for the department for about 14 years. I've chosen to work in this environment and with this population to help those in need. The population I work with is often forgotten about and underserved, yet have a dramatic impact on our communities. I also work with this population in an attempt to make our communities safer. My coworkers and I have chosen to work in a unique environment with a high-risk population because it's important. We put ourselves at risk daily to help people change and make Minnesota safer. The Lionel Lakes facility is the treatment facility for the department, so any offender that is sent to the Lionel Lakes facility is there to do either substance abuse treatment or sex offender treatment. The program in which I work offers substance abuse treatment. We serve offenders with substance abuse disorders. We also challenge thinking and beliefs related to their criminal behaviors. Most clients participate in the program for about 4 to 7 months. This length of time in treatment offers them a chance to address issues that result in their incarceration and the victimization of our communities. Currently in the triad program, we have several vacant positions. The unit that I work on is fully staffed with 6 therapists. We currently only have 3. That means of the 76 offenders living on that unit, only 43 are receiving treatment. The other beds are filled with general population offenders, making treatment really hard to do on the unit. In an attempt to alleviate some of the hardship on the triad program, therapists from other facilities have been sent to help, causing their own facilities.
I'm sorry, can I interrupt you for just a second? They're housing the treatment people in with the general population?
So the triad program is a separate building, and in order to keep the beds full, those that aren't in treatment are often in general population offenders.
I've never seen a model where that works.
It's tough. It's okay. Really tough. Yep.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, that's right. So other therapists have been brought to the triad program to help, leaving their own facilities and programs shorthanded. This also has disrupted programming in triad. Schedules have been changed to accommodate the visiting staff. We have also started new groups facilitated by the visiting staff, which then leaves the triad staff with more offenders to manage on a day-to-day basis on top of our already busy schedules. Some of the other difficulties that come with short staffing include increased safety risks to staff and offenders. Most recently, triad experienced a significant staff assault. A corrections officer was assaulted by 2 offenders that were under the influence of homemade alcohol. In 14 years, that's the first time I've ever experienced a staff assault in the triad program or any offenders under the influence of alcohol. This increased stress in an already stressful environment. My coworkers and I have increased our hypervigilance. We're always on the lookout now after this incident. It's my opinion that staffing levels directly relate to our safety, and being fully staffed would have prevented this and many other incidences. The mission of the Department of Corrections is to reduce recidivism by promoting offender change through proven strategies during safe and secure incarceration and effective community supervision. And the Department of Corrections says that safety through supporting a safe, safety-conscious environment for staff and offenders is a top value. We're unable to fully realize this mission without quality staff providing services to those incarcerated. Offenders that are mandated to treatment during their incarceration are not receiving services because there are not enough staff to provide those services. This is also impacting their ability to participate in other programming like work release and minimum. I want to thank you for taking the time and allowing me to share my experiences providing treatment in a correctional facility. With your help, the employees of the Department of Correction can work effectively to make Minnesota safer.
Thank you. Representative Wogemont, do you have any other testifiers?
Do we have a question for you?
Let's open it up for public testimony first. Okay. Anybody from the audience that wants to weigh in on this? Not seeing anybody. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wogemont, could you break down the 167 positions, please?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Poston, we don't have a current breakdown on it because it varies from facility to facility based on what the staffing allocation is. But some of the positions that are included are nursing staff, our CPTs, particularly in threes and fours. And those are the clinical program therapists, such as Ms. Winsberger. There are integrated case management specialists that help connect folks who are currently incarcerated to begin planning and connective services back into the community so that when they're released, they're set up for success. It also includes folks from DOC to focus on recruitment, because we do have a recruiting issue of bringing more COs in, given even with the additional FTEs, and folks to actually fill the spots that are already vacant, such as the additional three vacancies in Lionel Lakes. So those are kind of the broad overview of the classifications that would be included in this bill.
Thank you.
Follow-up?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Wilgamott, has there been a fiscal note requested on this?
Thank you, Mr. Please, Chair. Representative Poston, there was a fiscal note requested last year. It hadn't been completed. We are still kind of waiting on what it was, what the status of it was. I don't think it was ever finished. Some of the bill was incorporated last year into the omnibus bill, but not all of the positions. So we don't currently have an estimate of the actual cost.
Thank you.
One more?
Well, one more question, Mr. Chair. We didn't mention the need for any further correction officers. Is there a need for further correction officers up and above what we're already looking for?
Mr. Bruce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, yes, there is a need. We currently, however, are having, as was related when the OLA report was released, that there is a difficulty in actually hiring into the positions. Under some of the new contracts, there are recruiting incentives and higher pay scales, so hopefully coupled with that and with this bill where we have more recruitment staff, we can hire into those positions and fill the ones that are already vacant. I think there, from the last numbers that we heard over at Stillwater, there's over 50 vacancies, and that's for FTEs. It's not necessarily positions, but we still do have a shortage in staff everywhere, and that compromises security of both the CEOs, the population, and our clinical staff.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Novotny, you got you already?
I got it on the last
one. Anybody else? Quick comment. Last couple of years of the Blue Earth County Jail, I really wanted to put a treatment plan program in there. The thing that tripped it up was we could not dedicate an entire housing unit, and pretty much was under the impression that unless we could do that, we were wasting our time. Back to the fact, though, that a busy resident is a safe resident, and if they have some hope and they think they're making some progress, things will get a lot safer. Thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. We'll lay it over. Next. Whoops. I'm being corrected again. What? We're going to lay it over. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, next we have L, Representative Wilgamott. And I believe you have some testifiers for this also?
I do, Mr. Chair.
They want to make their way down at this point?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Poston.
Sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Chair. We do not have that bill, this bill in our package.
You don't? I haven't looked at it yet. Okay. Do we have a page available? You're going to jump on it? Okay, good. All right, we're going to move on to Representative Christensen. We'll come back to this one in just a second as soon as we get some copies of the bill. My apology, guys, that that wasn't in there. And this one is referred to the Ways and Means. And testifier, Commissioner Snell, would you like to join her at the table? Okay, Representative Christensen, your motion is to refer this to the General Registry, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Okay. Chair.
You want to make that motion?
So moved. So moved.
Okay, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am here today with Commissioner Snell to introduce HF 3772 to you. HF 3772 is a Department of Corrections agency bill that combines six different changes into one proposal. While the commissioner will help run us through these and explain the need for them, I wanted to remind that several of these provisions passed this committee in the House last session as part of my bill HF 2127. As part of that bill, you heard and passed language for the Red Wing per diem change and the DOC Medical Director Authority proposal. You also heard the proposal pertaining to DOC's Fugitive Apprehension Unit, the law enforcement unit within the Department of Corrections. However, this bill does have updates to that language that the commissioner can talk more about. In addition to last year's proposals that you heard, as part of my bill, we also have provisions to mandate the department to provide feminine hygiene products, a basic dignity issue for women who are incarcerated, and update some outdated language in two statutes related to corrections functions. Without further ado, I'll hand this over to Commissioner Snell.
Commissioner Snell, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. These change items really reflect an updating, as Representative Christensen pointed out. I'll just touch briefly on them, and then answer any questions you may have. The issue around feminine hygiene products being offered and ensuring that that happens really stems from an issue that occurred, many of you will recall, where there was a supply issue at the DOC, and that became an issue, and I think this bill really sets in place a state policy that mandates that be provided at no cost to people, regardless of the supply issues that we may face. Second is the Fugitive Apprehension Unit, as Representative Christensen pointed out, that this was in the bill last year. What is expanded in this is that one of the things that we see is that we have staff who are our law enforcement, our peace officers, and they conduct a variety of investigations that occur in the facilities and are on the facilities' properties. And what we want to do is ensure that they have the legal authority to conduct those investigations, certainly in consultation with local law enforcement agencies. But ultimately that they have the ability to conduct those investigations and make presentations of those cases to local county attorneys. The medical director decision making really is for those people who inmates who may be in a medical setting who do not have people who can make decisions on their behalf. This would allow the medical director at the DOC to make decisions on their behalf, which has and periodically does come up. There is also some slight changes in language, updating of language related to the cultural programming and services in that American Indian counseling bill, counseling language that was in law since, I believe, 1985. And this just updates that to make it more current. That came about as a result of consultation with tribal communities across the state. And then finally, we focus some on the billing issues related to confinement of juveniles and removing punishment as a goal of intensive community supervision. We believe that intensive community supervision is really about ensuring reintegration, successful reintegration, and punishment should not be a fundamental objective. Accountability certainly is part of the role of the agents who provide these services, but it, their job in and of itself is not to, to punish. So that's just a brief overview of each of those items, and I can stand for any questions you may have.
Okay, before we actually do questions, Representative Tapke, I believe you have an amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I have an amendment. It is Amendment A20-0673, and what the amendment does is it is at the request of Ramsey County and was passed last year as part of a separate bill, and this amendment is being made again at Ramsey County's request. And the amendment was passed last session as part of HF 1714 and in the Senate, but got lost at the end of session. And we're trying to get a small deletion in the County Corrections, Community Corrections Department in Ramsey County as part of this bill as well.
My understanding is to get rid of redundant language.
Yes, it's a technical change. It gets rid of redundant language at the behest of Ramsey County, and as I understand, Department of Corrections is fully on board with doing this as well.
Any questions or concerns? Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I direct this at the author or whoever can answer this question. But
this is about the amendment first.
About the amendment, yes. It looks like the A20-0673 amendment is repealing the Ramsey County Community Corrections Department. You know, I'm a little confused by that, if you could explain that.
I'm calling a friend, Representative. Thank you.
Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, members. My name is Chris, C-H-R-I-S, last name Crutchfield, C-R-U-T-C-H-F-I-E-L-D. I'm the Deputy Director of Ramsey County Community Corrections. Mr. Chair, members, the 383A 404 was written in 1974, and it is a Ramsey County only statute. All the other corrections counties are follow 401, which is the Community Corrections Act statute, and we would simply want to follow that. So getting rid of this doesn't get rid of our department. It just allows us to follow the modern Corrections Act statute, which we would like to follow.
Very good. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions, comments, any concerns from the audience? Okay. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. The amendment is added. Okay. So now, did we do public testimony on yours? Okay. All right, now on the bill, is there anybody else that wishes to weigh in from the public? Not seeing anyone. Questions from the committee? Not seeing any of those. We will refer this to the general registry. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Chair will renew the motion as amended to refer to the general registry. Thank God for my committee administrator. all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Okay. Next. All right. Are we ready with Representative Wolgmuth? You guys get a copy of the bill? Nope, I guess we don't have it yet. All right. We're in the prisons. Okay, I think I'm going to just do it from here. All right, the next person up is me. Unless somebody has an objection, I'm going to do it from right here. I guess I better not. I will be down there. Representative Wolgamont, do you want to come take the gavel?
All right. Representative Considine moves to re-refer House File 2010 to the Judiciary Committee.
So moved. Okay. We have discussed this a couple of times last year. We've discussed it once already this year. Last thing that brought it back here is we had some concerns about data privacy. I believe those have been ironed out. If they haven't, I'm pretty sure that Chair Lesch will make sure they are in the Judiciary Committee, which is where we're referring it to. Would you like to say a few words?
I'm Brett Onsted, Correctional Officer with Ramsey County. Spoke here last week. And I'd just like to add that I think that this bill is very important. Recently, I had to defend a fellow officer who was not told until the moment before he went in to an investigation, and even during the investigation he wasn't told what he was being investigated for. He was shown a video and asked to explain his actions, most of which weren't even related to the initial charge. This is kind of a common practice, and it's not in line with what police officers and peace officers are allowed to do or given the rights. And with inmates learning the tricks of how to put an officer in defense has been getting more and more sophisticated. And I think that this would help with officers being able to do their job much more effectively. I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. Members, any questions for this testifier? Farewell. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I understand that you have an amendment. Representative Considine moves to amend House File 2010 with the A3 amendment in order to put the bill in the shape that the author would like it. Representative Considine, would you like to explain the A1 amendment?
That's the one that has to do with data privacy and tightening it up so that we make sure that we're within the guidelines that have been established by the state of Minnesota.
Well, members, any discussion or questions? Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Considine, I'm still a little bit confused about the amendment. Could you explain it in a little more detail, please?
Chair Considine.
I'm going to pass that one over to Mr. Frommke.
Mr. Chair, my name is Gus Frommke. I'm with Teamsters Local 320. The concern was brought up by MECAC, which is the Community Corrections Organization. And they basically looked at the statute currently for peace officers, where the peace officer has the ability to sign whether they want the investigation or the complaint to notify their exclusive representative, which would be their union representative. The way the current 2010 is written, it would be an automatic notification to the exclusive rep. We decided that we wanted to keep the notification, but we also wanted to allow the officer to withhold any of the information in the investigation from the exclusive rep if that officer does not want to share that information with their exclusive rep. So essentially a notification will still go to the exclusive rep that there is an investigation, but it will have none of the details included in it.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Considine. And so we spent a couple of weeks talking through the intricacies of this in my office, and I really appreciate Gus's description of it, because what we're trying to do, members, is to really balance out this issue of the rights established under law and through negotiations for the representative of the individual and the data privacy rights of the individual. And that can get a little tricky. I think you hit a really nice sweet spot with this language, but Mr. Chair, to Representative Paulson and the other committee members, this bill is going to be referred to Judiciary, I believe, and that's where we'll have a much deeper dive into the data privacy conversation. So this won't be the end of that discussion. That's an appropriate committee to do that with all sorts of folks on both sides of the aisle who are experts on data privacy issues.
Very well. Any further discussion on the A1 amendment? Very well. Very well. Representative Considine moves to amend House File 2010 with the A3 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. House File 2010 is before the committee as amended. Mr. Fromke, did you have any further testimony to provide?
No, I just would like to, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to thank this committee for their hard work and their support of corrections officers. Thank you.
Members, any further questions or discussions on House File 2010? Mr. Chair, any closing remarks?
No, just thankful to get this through and passed, or moved anyway.
Very well. Representative Considine renews his motion to re-refer House File 2010 as amended to the Judiciary Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 2010 has been re-referred as amended to the Judiciary Committee.
Chair Lesh, would you make your way down to the table?
Yes, I will.
Oh, good. Do you have some testifiers?
You know,
I don't know. Lots going on this time of year, Mr. Chair, so I forgot to check if I have testifiers. But I know that the commissioner's here. And
you want to make your way to the table in case? Okay, where are we? Are there any amendments?
No. Oh, thank you. Awesome.
Well, before we get started, I just want to thank Chair Lesh for digging into data privacy so well. I personally detest digging into it, so I really appreciate the fact that you do this in Judiciary. So proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You want to move it? Or
we can't. I'll vote, Mr. Chair.
Chair Mariani moves. Chair Lesh's.
House File 3008.
Two Ways and Means.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 3008 removes references of slavery from the Minnesota Constitution. This is an image of the original Minnesota Constitution signed in 1858, in the summer of 1858, when Minnesota became a state. And my great-great-great-grandfather signed a copy of this as a delegate from Scott County. He was actually the first county attorney in Carver County and signed tried the first murder case out in Carver County. I don't know who did it. I don't know if he won either, but he tried the first case. And it's significant because at the back of this document, I see his name, and it says Frank Warner, delegate from Scott County. And it reminds me of how significant it is the things that we do that last long term. This document prohibits slavery in all cases, slavery and involuntary servitude in all cases except when a person is adjudicated having received their due process rights. That I saw as problematic for reasons that I'll get into in a second. This was offered as an idea from St. Paul Police Chief Todd Axtell. It was a New Year's resolution thought that he had of something that we could actually do that would move Minnesota forward significantly. So there's two things I want to speak to about this particular bill amendment. This would be a constitutional amendment that would change the Constitution, removing that language that permits slavery in cases where one is adjudicated. The reason why this is important is because of Minnesota's origins. If you go out to the rotunda and you see the statues of the people that are out there, you see the indicia of the beginnings of our state. If you go to Washington, D.C., you'll see statues of the Founding Fathers and George Washington and the battles of the American Revolution, because that is our nation's origin story. This country is founded on a narrative of what it means to be free, the folks tossed tea into the harbor at Boston Harbor because of taxation without representation, and the bad King George who didn't allow us to govern ourselves. It's our nation's origin story. But Minnesota's origin story is the Civil War, because that's what happened when we became a state. And it's a very significant aspect of our origin story as well. The boot of the that's rubbed from the brass right outside the Capitol or the House chamber is Colonel William Colville. If you exit the House chamber and go to the right in the rotunda, that's Colonel William Colville. There are other folks up there, two statues of folks who have significant, parts of our origin story of our state. But the reason why that's important is because only a few years after the Minnesota Constitution was signed, the pivotal question of whether slavery would be allowed to continue in this nation was resolved through violence. And that's when our nation went to war with itself. So when the Confederate troops fired on Fort Sumter, it was actually cadets from the Citadel in South Carolina, fired on Fort Sumter, Alexander Ramsey, who was governor at the time, our second governor, he was a very anti-slavery governor as well. The previous governor, Henry Sibley, was not so much. We had folks coming to the state who would bring their slaves to the state, including folks like Dred Scott, who was at Fort Snelling and gave rise to the Dred Scott versus Sanford case in 1849. And there was a question about, well, we want these southern plantation owners to come up and spend money on vacation, and we can't totally be anti-slavery because they need their money. Alexander Ramsey was very anti-slavery and went straight to the White House and committed troops from the Minnesota to the preservation of the Union and the question of whether slavery would go on. Now, at the beginning of the Civil War, people know that it was a question, like, what was this war about? Was it about preserving the Union? Or was it about that critical social question of the time, which was crescendoing into the question of whether slavery would be allowed to be continued in this state? And by the time of the middle of the war, the Battle of Gettysburg, it was generally an accepted fact that the war was about whether or not slavery would be allowed to continue in the state at all. Most folks would agree that Gettysburg was the decisive battle of the war. It was when the war turned. And the decisive day of the 3 days of Gettysburg was the second day. And the decisive engagement of that day was the Battle of Plum Run. The reason that the Battle of Plum Run is important is because several hundred Minnesotans decided it. On that day, the several hundred Minnesotans who were led by Colonel William Colville on a several days forced march, Colonel William Colville showed up in manacles. He was under arrest at Gettysburg because he had allowed his troops to rest for an hour to get the sand out of their boots when they had crossed a stream in Northern Virginia. And command said, absolutely not. There's a battle raging. You get here now. He had allowed his troops 1 hour to rest. So he was arrested. And he showed up on Cemetery Ridge at Gettysburg in handcuffs. And as he was being unhandcuffed, General Hancock on the top of Cemetery Ridge where the Union was besieged saw the 28th Alabama charging down the hill from the other side. The line needed to remain intact. The 28th Alabama had troops that were going to divide the line. And General Hancock said to Colonel Colville, you see those colors, referring to the 28th Alabama, take those colors. So those several hundred Minnesotans who crested the top of Cemetery Ridge quickly saw that they were outnumbered 10 to 1. And they charged anyway. They knew when they crested that ridge that they were dead. Every single one of them knew that they were dead. These were Minnesotans. And at that time of the war, they also knew that what they were fighting for was whether slavery would continue in this nation. Not a single one of them fell out. Every single one of them marched through. And I'm sorry when I get choked up about this, because I was the battalion historian for 2 of the 135, which is the successor unit for the 1st Minnesota. And so I study this closely, and I still get choked up when I think about every single one of these Minnesota farm kids charged to their deaths on purpose so that slavery would end in this nation. Feel a little bit ridiculous getting choked up about it, but because it's 150 years ago. But that's why this is part of our origin story and why we need to get rid of it. It's really important that there's no way that slavery should ever be allowed, because our origin story of Minnesotans meant that our forebears died to this end. So the fact that there's a remaining question that slavery should ever be continued, I think it's really important that it be excluded from the state constitution. The legacy that I cannot speak to about this, okay? My legacy is Irish, and the Irish certainly weren't treated very well, okay? But it's very different from having a legacy of chattel slavery. The idea of ownership of a person, yes, it has a long history throughout human history. All peoples, all nations, all races enslaved each other. We finally get to this point in the middle of the 19th century where we finally get the sense of, okay, you know, this is kind of ridiculous. We need to end this. At the point where we got the crescendoing social ideology where it wasn't just slavery, but slavery got linked to race itself, to color itself, a particularly odious social construct of what our founders referred to as a peculiar institution. Even the founders knew this was weird, that there was something seriously wrong with it, but they benefited from it financially in a huge way. So they were trying to thread this moral needle that they seriously failed in, and it ended up in a war. That's why I think it's really important that we get this out of the Constitution. I apologize for getting choked up about that on there. I feel a little bit ridiculous about it, but I did study this in depth as the battalion historian, as the successor unit to the 1st Minnesota, so I feel a little bit close to it. And incidentally, there was an individual who wrote a book called The Last Full Measure. The title of the book taken from President Lincoln's speech at Gettysburg, referring specifically to the 1st Minnesota and what happened there. And his name was Richard Moe. And he was Walter Mondale's chief of staff when he was vice president under Carter. He left the White House in 1980 after Reagan was elected, went to work for a big Washington, D.C. law firm, hated practicing law, so spent all of his time doing other stuff after hours and writing this book about the 1st Minnesota, which is replete with information about what actually these kids went through. They were a diverse group of folks. They knew they were fighting to end slavery. They didn't necessarily think they had a personal stake in it, but they believed in it because of the ideology of it, because that idea of freedom was still very present for all these folks who were new Minnesotans
and they thought it was important. I think because of that, it is our legacy, it's our origin story, and we should think that it's important too. So I'd ask for your support.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Actually, I get kind of choked up about it too. For those that don't know, the Minnesota First has the highest casualty rate ever inflicted on a regiment in the history of the United States. And the next day, they decided to take it easy on them. They stuck them right in the middle of the line where it was going to be nice and safe. And that's where the Pickett's Charge took place. And that's actually where they took the flag from Virginia and brought it back. My great-great-grandfather packed up the family and left Arkansas to come. He was on the railroad to come up here, got off in Mankato, and then died outside of Nashville, Tennessee. So, yeah, I get a little choked about it, too, and it really irritates me when I see that cracker flag. Sorry, a little editorial there. Sorry. Chair Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lesh, and thank you for bringing this bill forward. And I've had conversations with you and with Chair Considine and other members of this body who have within family memory the incredible trauma and sacrifice that Americans made to end slavery. And I have to tell you, I'm not an original Minnesotan, I'm a Puerto Rican, but you know, I share in that pride of this state standing up for some of the most core virtues that any race should have and any nation should have. And I, as a member of this body, want to be able to continue to honor the incredible sacrifice that they made. I've read some of the letters, Mr. Chair, that young Minnesotans were sending back to mom and dad here during the war. And it's not hyperbole. They were clearly involved in a battle to clearly end slavery. They spoke of it, as they wrote messages back to their parents. And so I think this legislation is in keeping with that spirit. I have a couple of very quick questions for you. The first one is just an obvious one. So we have language in the Constitution. I take it that in order to change that, we have to take action through this way, language before the people. So that's something that we don't have as a legislative body permission to do. Nonetheless, are there other ways in which we can take statutory action? And in particular, I'm interested in, I know Colorado did something about this recently. Maybe if you're aware of that, you can share a little bit about what they did.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Chair Mariani. So Colorado is the only state so far that has successfully amended their constitution via ballot measure.
Okay.
And other measures now exist in Utah and Nebraska. And in our last hearing, actually, we had a fantastic testifier, from a professor from St. Cloud State, who I gave great answers as to why this language is in there. This language, which is mirrored in the U.S. Constitution, and these constitutions in these 26 other states, comes directly from the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. And so that's why it's there. We could, potentially amend this via statute as well. But, with the constitutional language being in there, it's problematic. So if there was a conflict between our statutory language and Constitution, the Constitution would win out, hence the amendment.
Well, and Mr. Chair, Lesh, there are many that would argue that that the mass incarceration state that we slid into, in my opinion, slid into in the last couple decades, in many ways is a proxy for the taking away of liberties of people based on the color of their skin. And obviously through the filter of criminal, being accused of criminal activity. But nonetheless, the statistics are just obscenely shocking about who's in jail and who's not. And it seems to me that for us to live out our values of freedoms and liberty, we can't be blind to the incredible power of racism and the way it works implicitly on our psychologies and the way we view the world. And so I think that your proposal is not just words on paper. I think it's about continuing to shine a light in as we move toward that more perfect union of humanity. And the work is not going to cease. We're going to continue to push on criminal justice reform, on the relationships between our law enforcement, which we need and we honor, and communities, which is another way to say that this is good anti-racism work that this proposal represents. And I'm proud to support it, and the work is going to continue to be very difficult. Even with passage of this, as we work to better ourselves, citizens and human beings. So thank you, Representative Lesh, for this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Considine, I appreciate you bringing that up, Chair Mariani, because, you know, as a guy who grew up white in the suburbs, Irish heritage and Silesian heritage, my Silesian great-grandfather fought in the war. He wasn't at Gettysburg, but he did fight in the Civil War. I've had to think a lot about what this means of the legacy of that, what the founders referred to as a peculiar institution in our nation's history, and how it was relevant to me. And I think the conclusion I came to over the decades of trying to learn this and study this and represent the folks I represent was having to decide whether those words that we learned in sixth grade civics that said we take these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, if I really believed those. I mean, do we really believe them? And if we do believe them, we have to look at ourselves in the mirror as individuals and as a nation and say, what in the hell is going on? Why do we have these massive disparities? Because if we believe A, that everyone's created equal, and B, there are massive disparities on the back end of justice and due process, something is seriously wrong. And it's a systemic problem. We're inclined to blame individuals or groups or whatever, and it's not. It's all of our fault that we have created this system over time. So it's my hope that this is a part of how we can help to undo that, albeit maybe even a small way. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Lesh, I just want to say thank you for bringing this forward, and thank you for the history lesson this morning.
Did we do public testimony? We did? Well, we didn't. Public testimony, or we'll start with, I'm sorry, Commissioner Snell, you're first.
Good morning, again, Mr. Chair and members. First of all, I just would like to say, I for one, and I think has been mentioned by several of the members, I'm grateful for the lesson and really, frankly, for the emotion with which this comes forward. I think, as Chair Mariani points out as well, these issues are foundational to what we stand on and what's happening today. We spend far too much time admiring the problem of disparities within our system. And I think this is a way of going at and looking at the foundational issues that ultimately result in and create the conditions with which these disparities can exist and flourish. I just want to offer a couple of quick comments. First of all, representing the Department of Corrections, I will just say that we believe that slavery and involuntary servitude in any form are abhorrent and have no place in Minnesota. Without exception, to this day, communities across our state continue to grapple with the impact of the legal enslavement of human beings in our country, and will continue to do so for generations to come. Slavery or involuntary servitude as punishment for a crime is a gross violation of human rights and should not be condoned, let alone written into Minnesota's Constitution. We wholeheartedly support this proposed amendment. The Minnesota Department of Corrections exists to transform lives, to make Minnesota a safer place to live, and slavery and involuntary servitude as punishment for a crime does nothing to advance that mission. We would say that research does continually show that the people who are in the system, who are actively engaged in pro-social behaviors and maintain connections to the world outside of prison are most successful upon their release. Idle time is one of the strongest drivers of misconduct while people are in prison and a significant predictor of failure upon release. We mention this only because some people have raised the question of how does this relate to what happens in our prisons today. We rely on and use a data-driven approach to engage people in our prisons in activities and programming that are designed to prepare them to be released back into the community. This includes skills training, work and education programs, counseling, therapy, treatment, and advancement toward post-secondary educational degrees, medical and mental health care. We do require people who are in our facilities to engage in some form of programming. This can be programming of oftentimes of their choice. This could be a job, it could be school, or other programming that the department offers. At the end of the day, all these programs are designed to help people prepare for release and full reintegration and acceptance into our community. With that, Mr. Chair, members, I would stand for any questions, but we are grateful that this measure is being considered and stand in full support.
Not seeing any questions, is there anyone from the public that would like to weigh in? Not seeing anybody getting up. I'm sorry, Representative Knott, did you have, no. Representative Mariani, you want to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, yes. I would renew my motion that House File 3008 be referred to
Ways and Means?
Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, same signal. Okay. Moving on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
As passed. All right. You guys got the bill finally? Again, sorry that took a while. Representative Wolgamott. Where are we at? Representative Wolgamott, I understand you're going to move this to the General Registry.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm here this morning to present House File 3911. It's a Department of Corrections agency bill, and I'm proud to be the chief author. I have Commissioner Snell here with me to give you more information about the bill itself and what it does. We also have experts from the Department of Corrections Office of Special Investigations here joining us. They'll be able to answer your questions, but I wanted to tell you a little bit about why this bill is a top priority for me and for my constituents. Mr. Chair and members, as you're aware, I represent the district that houses one of the 11 state correctional facilities. In fact, it is the oldest state correctional facility, the St. Cloud State Prison. Mr. Chair and committee members, just last Wednesday, we heard about the stunning findings from the OLA report regarding the safety and security challenges inside state prisons. And I was encouraged by the widespread support that we had as a committee to take action on those findings. Across the country and right here in Minnesota, our correctional facilities are dealing with growing threats posed by technology, including drones. Advancements in technology make certain aspects of corrections safer, but others raise new challenges. The possibility of someone intentionally capturing imagery or video of DOC facilities and then publicly sharing it produces serious risks to the security of our correctional facilities. The likelihood of someone introducing items inside our correctional facilities, such as cell phones, drugs, or even guns, poses a grave threat to the safety of our correction staff and the residents of these facilities. Mr. Chair, members, this is not just some imaginary scenario. This is happening all across our country. At least 13 states have already passed bills prohibiting drones from flying over and or introducing items into our correctional facilities. And Mr. Chair, if you'll allow it, I have one such example to show you on video.
Proceed.
So this is a drone dropping off some a cell phone. So there you go. That could, Mr. Chair, that could just easily happen in one of our Minnesota correctional facilities. That happened in Ohio. It was a drone dropping a cell phone and drugs inside a correctional facility. So, as you can see, it's easy to use technology to create severe security risks inside our correctional facilities. So, Mr. Chair and members, I encourage you to check out coverage across the country on this issue because there is plenty, and my hope is that we can have support for this bill and increase the safety and security of our correctional facilities. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I will hand this over to Commissioner Schnell for his testimony, and I believe we also have other testifiers here as well to speak to the importance of this piece of legislation.
Commissioner Schnell. Once again, good morning, Chair, committee members. Paul Schnell, the Commissioner of Corrections. First, I want to say thank you to Representative Wolgamont and all the co-authors for supporting this agency bill. Our department is grateful for the forward thinking and assistance with keeping our facilities safe. Chair and members, House File 3911 before you today does the following things that are gaps in current law. First, it makes knowingly flying a drone over a correctional facility a misdemeanor, unless someone has requested permission, obtained permission from the commissioner or a designee for consent and has received it. While some may argue flying over a correctional facility does not pose any risk, we disagree. Most drones have the capability of capturing images or video. We have no way of knowing if the drone is actually actively capturing images of our facility and security protocols or not. So it's important that we have the ability to take action should that become a reality and these images become distributed online and compromise our security. Secondly, this bill would make it a gross misdemeanor to capture images and videos of our correctional facilities. And third, it makes it a gross misdemeanor to introduce any items inside a correctional facility via drone that are not already covered under the Minnesota Statute 243.55, which addresses issues of contraband, but largely only covers controlled substances, alcohol, weapons, and the like. Cell phones and other types of information, notes, communications are not covered under that law. As Representative Wolgamont stated, at least 13 states have already passed this legislation. And speaking with the commissioners and my role across the country, this remains a top security concern for all of my peers. Even our neighbors in Wisconsin have passed such legislation into law already. How big is this problem in Minnesota? We don't know the full scope yet, but we are actively trying to put together numbers. the agency acquired and placed the single drone detection device into service in July of 2019. The device and software interface is currently licensed through June of 2020. Half of the facilities, about five of them, use that system in 2019, and the other half will do it this spring in 2020. The goal was really to begin collecting baseline data regarding drone intrusions over the facilities. We have a hope to determine the timing and based on risk to request funds that would invest in more robust drone detection systems. We also have a snapshot of the intrusions during a short 3-week deployment at some of our facilities. We are using a pretty limited entry-level model, but it does provide us with notifications of intrusions into airspace directly above our facilities. It also identifies the manufacturer, and in many cases, the model of the drones that it can detect. Over the course of the 3 weeks detection cycles that we have put in place, we've detected the following number of drone intrusions at five of our facilities. In Faribault, we've, in 1 3-week period, 7, Stillwater 15, St. Cloud 4, Oak Park Heights 1, and Lino 4. We were to project that out annually. In Stillwater, as a for instance, we're talking about 260 drone intrusions during the course of a year, 120 in Faribault, about 70 at St. Cloud, about 70 in Lino. And as you can see, this is a growing concern and issue. Our bill essentially helps us get ahead of that curve, and we would ask for your support of this bill. And with that, members, I can stand for any questions that you may have.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author and the commissioner, whoever can answer this question, it's a really good bill. Thank you for bringing it forward. The consent, Commissioner, is that written consent?
Commissioner Stone.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poston, yes, we would provide written consent, and oftentimes, even today, we may, the State Patrol is going to be doing something. They will notify us in many cases if they're going to be flying over, so that these things happen, but which they are not required to get a consent, but as a courtesy, they often let us know. In this case, we would be providing written consent.
Yeah. Representative Wolgamott, you might add that into 1.9. That it's written consent. I think it would clarify that piece. My next question is, does this include county facilities or is this just state facilities?
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poston, it's a great question. We actually did meet with the Sheriff's Association and talk about this. They are supportive. There was not many sheriff's offices whose jails had outside yards. Now, I was just thinking about the fact that having Ramsey County here, they have their workhouse, which does have outside yards and recreational sites. Right now, this really it really focuses on this, but ultimately, I believe it does address correctional facility more generally.
Representative Poston, any more follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's important that the county correctional units get included in this. And I understand a lot of them don't have yards, but I also can see these things hovering around windows and all kinds of other things. And in fact, two nights ago, I saw on television, we see more and more about these drones, where these drones can lift several hundred pounds. So I suppose the next thing you're gonna be looking at is a drone lifting someone out of a facility. I hope not, but it's probably coming.
Yeah.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Representative Tapke. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Wolgamott, I am a co-author on this and I very much support this, but I have a couple of questions and concerns. So the Shakopee Correctional Facility is in the middle of a residential neighborhood. It is also next to a an elementary school, a cemetery. There's a lot of different aspects going on than many of the other correctional facilities. So how would this apply to in Shakopee if someone that's just across the street within, you know, 20 yards of buildings within the correctional facility and that kind of thing, if someone across the street is flying a drone and they are taking pictures of their kids or their house and they have photos of the correctional facility grounds in the background or whatever is going on, how would this apply to that kind of situation?
Commissioner Snow.
Mr. Chair, I think that's a great question. Really what we are looking at is if it's background, it just happened that they capture that in the background. It's really about flying over the facility or over the immediate property that that facility sits on. We really are looking at those places where our security could be compromised. That is the biggest concern.
Follow-up, Representative Tapke.
And then secondly with that, what if a drone from a residential neighborhood gets off course and flies over over the facility? What happens at that point? Is it automatically gross misdemeanor, or how do you plan on handling that kind of thing?
Commissioner Snow.
Mr. Chair, I think ultimately what we believe would happen is more and more there is a requirement even for recreational users that they are supposed to be trained in the use of these devices. We plan, if assuming this passes, that we would be working with the FAA to actually delineate from a geofencing kind of standpoint with them the boundaries of that facility so that people would know, oftentimes would know. The typical recreational user wouldn't. And I think the other reality is that the law does require that they are knowingly engaged in this activity. We're not looking at going after people who made a mistake and something like that happened. There has to be some level of knowing intent to do that. I mean, ultimately, the purpose of this is really to address the issues of safety and security. It's not to criminalize people who made a mistake.
One more, Representative Tapke?
Yep, I've got another one. Thank you. So then my last question with it is that, as well, at the Shakopee facility, there's a large open ground. It's just a big lawn area that, unless you know that that's correctional facility land, you would have no idea that that's anything but an open park land or anything like that. How will that kind of thing be handled as well, where it's not necessarily delineated? I'm sure that there are other areas across the state where Department of Corrections owns land, and there are no facilities there at this time.
Commissioner Snow.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are, again, really focused on the properties and the grounds immediately adjacent to the facilities. Again, the whole purpose of this is really about the security of that facility. And so the area, the land around the buildings itself, so across at Shakopee, across that street where we have that land, would not be an area that we would have concerns about because there are not any kind of security functions occurring there.
Got it. Thank you very much for giving me time to do my best Representative O'Neill impression today.
She is thorough. Representative Novotny.
Chairman Constantine, Commissioner Snell, does your unit have any ability right now to detect who's actually being responsible for the controlling of the drones?
Commissioner Snow.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as this develops and as the FAA kind of establishes these rules even for recreational users and more there's training, because of the drone detection devices, we are able to, there's a growing kind of ability to learn and determine who that may be affiliated with. Now, in some cases, that will be challenging. There is also technology today that just the use of different types of laser stuff can follow, because recreational users are supposed to maintain a visual line of sight to the device. And so there is some ability to track where that device was launched from or returns to. So there are things from a technology standpoint that can be done. I think for purposes of this as a starting point, we really wanted to be in a place where we begin to set this as a state policy. The federal government, the FAA, does in fact prohibit flying a drone over a federal correctional facility. It did not apply, however, to state facilities. So I think really what this is the beginning of that. And as this technology develops, as the FAA takes more action, we believe that those possibilities are going to be far greater to track back exactly who's launching that.
Thank you, Commissioner Snell, because as you know, next weekend you could be calling me to go look for who's outside the St. Cloud prison flying this drone. It'd be nice to have some information beforehand to know what's going on and what you can and can't do right, as far as your capabilities. And one more question, Chairman Constantine.
Representative.
Have you been any conversation with the FAA about intercepting or interrupting those signals to stop that?
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are, if this passes, we would be working with the FAA, which would really then establish those boundaries. So that flight, you know, for commercial drone pilots, flight paths that are submitted to the FAA actually are approved and reviewed by the FAA, that those things get addressed. We, you know, as I think across the country and in talking with my colleagues around the country, more and more there are conversations that are happening with the FAA to address the safety and security concerns and ultimately, to be able to better track. The challenge for us, as you know, is the recreational user is the because today you can buy a pretty sophisticated drone that can carry a small payload. Any of us could do it for a relatively small amount of money. And so the ability to fly into or over a correctional facility, drop something or land something, would be fairly easy today. And I think as this technology advances, you know, we need to be more on top of the ways that we address them and track back where they're coming from and what exactly the purposes are of people flying them.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Snell, but just to follow up on that is we're not that far away from the drones that have the capability of taking out smaller persons. So that would be, you know, I'm suggesting now is the time to start having that conversation with the feds and the FAA. I know from working with security at the Monticello plant and the perimeter of there are devices available. It's a matter of what the FAA will give you permission to do. So it'd be nice if we start looking at a proactive standpoint as opposed to a reactive standpoint.
I believe there's also technology on the horizon where you can actually put up like an electrical fence where the drone can only go so far and it is automatically stopped. But I think that's still in development.
Mr. Chair, I believe we have additional folks who came to St. Paul to testify on this today.
Okay, we're looking at about 6-7 more minutes, and we got a few more bills. Let's move this right along. CO Rick, please state your name for the.
Thank you, Chairman. It's not usually my nature to make things brief, but I will.
Thank you.
My name is Sergeant Rick Nyson. I've been at the correctional facility in St. Cloud for 27 years. One of those jobs that I've had over the years is our yard sergeant security officer. That in and of itself, when I started 27 years ago, part of the job was to walk the interior of the 55 acres in St. Cloud, looking for things thrown over, softballs, drugs, whatever. Obviously, with the testimony of the commissioner and others, we're in a different place. The one thing that I really want to put a fine point on that we didn't talk about is the recreational use around the facility and how we need to react to seeing a drone. We don't always see them, but when we do, a whole bunch of things go into action. We have to switch everybody in. We have to secure the area. If we're really being proactive, we have to keep the offenders that are in the yard quarantined and separated because we're not sure if contraband has been introduced. The capture of the security aspect of it is concerning, But for those of us that walk inside the walls, the thing that is very concerning is the ability to have a payload and to drop weapons and drugs, because that's our safety. So in and of that, having to disrupt, you know, to shut everything down, we are disrupting programming. We're putting stressors on an already short-staffed system. So I'm here also representing AFSCME. We support this bill wholeheartedly and would really like to see it go through. So I don't know if anybody has any questions for me, but.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jack, I wanted to take one moment for AFSCME to thank you for all the work that you and your committee do. You've been a champion for us, and we really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're up. You want to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion, and I ask for your support to make this support for this bill to make our correctional facilities and the people who live there and the people who work there more safe and secure.
Any more discussion? Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Passes and moves forward. Okay, now hopefully we can run through the next couple of things rather quickly. We're going to re-refer Representatives Edelson's bill with out a recommendation. H-3109 is not in the proper committee of jurisdiction. Therefore, I move to refer the bill without recommendation. This bill will move to its proper jurisdiction without prejudice, meaning by moving the bill, the committee are not signing off on its contents, only reassigning it to a different committee. So I'm going to move that we re-refer this to public safety. Any discussion about that particular? Good. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Okay, we're re-referring that to Chairman Mariani's committee. All right, let's see. Representative Mariani, okay. As has been stated in public safety, it's my desire to honor last year's bills by not relitigating the same language we've heard and passed earlier in the biennium. For that reason, it's my intention that we pass these bills without testimony, debate, or substantive amendments. First one, Representative Mariani. First of all, is there anybody objecting to that particular? I'd like to know that now before I. Okay. Good. Thank you. Do you want to briefly brief? No, you don't want him to briefly? He doesn't do briefly? Okay. All right. Okay. Representative Mariani's bill on intermittent sentence release board. Can we do this all in one?
Nope.
One at each time. Okay. All those in favor. Representative Mariani moves to re-refer this to the General Register. Any discussion? She's saying it's supposed to go to Ways and Means.
Yeah.
You get General Register.
What, Chair, I'm not sure. I don't know why we would need to go to Ways and Means.
You want to weigh in on that real quickly?
I think the reason it needs to go to Ways and Means is the fiscal note aspect of it, Chair.
Chair, I stand corrected. There's the fiscal aspect. And Ways and Means would be the appropriate.
Thank you for your help on that particular one. We will re-refer it then to Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. One of the things I've liked about this committee is the help that you guys have thrown out on some things when make a mistake. All right. Bill 1237, state and local prison and prison inmates are required to be housed in publicly owned and operated jails and prisons. We're going to re-refer. Representative Wolgamont.
Mr. Chair, I move to re-refer House File 1237 to the Public Safety Committee.
Any discussion on that? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All any opposed, same sign. Good. We're moving right along. We'll move that forward. Anything other business that needs to come before this committee? No? Any other last-minute corrections from you? No? Okay. All right. I really do love my committee administrator. I don't care what it looks like out there. okay, we're adjourned. Thank you.